Our next speaker is Mehri Honarbi Holiday, and she's an Action Iran activist, as well as a postdoctoral researcher at Canterbury Christchurch University. And for me, her talk tonight really resonates as one of the key goals of Action Iran, and that is to put a human face on this whole debate, to move away from the mad mullahs, as Paul puts it, and to really try and humanize who is it we're talking about.
The people of Iran, ladies and gentlemen, have made immense contributions to the development of ideas for millennia. They have registered these ideas not only in writing, as recently as 600 BC in tablet form and in mountain carvings, but also in forms such as architecture, sculpture, plaques, seals and vessels made up of diverse materials in bitumen compounds and terracotta around 4000 BC in locations such as Susa. In the basement of the National Museum in Tehran, and in more elaborate locations such as the Sackler Gallery in Washington, D.C., and the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and nearer to us at the Vatican and other illustrious locations in Europe, I have seen examples of cultural artifacts in fired clay made by the Iranian people and dated as early as 6000 BC by multinational scholars. Such significant heritage must not be viewed in terms of the past only. Despite a recent history of political turmoil, socio-political limitations and isolation at the beginning of the 21st century, Iran finds itself with a youthful face whose ambition is to sustain heritage, this heritage, into the future. Nearly three quarters of Iranian population is under the age of 30. According to the 2004-2005 national statistics published by the Ministry of Education's educational program, 15,815,638 individuals are engaged in primary and secondary education. From this figure, over 500,000 are adults seeking literacy, 8 million are boys and 7 million are girls. Additionally, there are 3 million students in higher education, including vocational training, many of whom have entered urban spaces from remote towns and villages for the first time. Significantly, over 60% of this student body are female. It is this layer of society in contemporary Iran that I would like to draw your attention to, the youth. I invite you to imagine their ambitions and aspirations, their struggles, their uncertainties, and their longings and strife to construct lives and be part of the world at large. I invite you to recognize them as valued members of the global society, whose growth and development must not be interrupted. These young people and their families, friends and relatives, which means 75 million Iranians, must not be bombed. Their homes, their schools and universities, their sources of their and their livelihoods must not be shattered. Their aspirations and their future must not be ruined. And in no way must sanctions be imposed on them. Many of them are already economically vulnerable. We simply cannot afford to view these young people in abstraction, for they are real and they are at large with critical and reflexive minds. They must be allowed to claim their space. They must be given space to find paths to develop, reflect on ideas, and take those ideas forward in order to continue to make contributions to the future of the world. Any form of military sanctions and military attacks on Iran is detrimental to their development. I will present them here through their own voices given to me in interviews. This is Sara. She says, the socio-political boundaries in our society promote us to be less truthful. We develop a profound sense of duality in our character without even realizing it. But we see it in others. There is no debate. What does it mean to be good or bad? It's not clear. We don't want to be good all the time. We see things differently to our parents, to our government. We want to think for ourselves, explore ideas, including sexuality, drinking. must we be viewed so differently from our peers around the world? This is Behna. The power systems in the West seek to enslave us. Did you know that the Americans have already been to the countries north of the Caspian Sea and secured rights for the future pipelines in the gas in the region? The gas, which is still deep underground and not yet being decided for or its extent fully clarified by the indigenous people. You question me about autonomy and art. Let me tell you about your celebrity-ridden autonomous art, your worship of anything that is driven by money. When Christo wraps mountains in cloth, when he covers a skyscraper in Berlin and stands on top to be worshipped as the object in space, he is ruled by capitalism and the money it depends on. Just think about the sponsorships. Money. Probably the oil money, the money we cannot have, the money we need to spend on 1,001 things to improve lives here and to secure futures here. This is Anahita. Yes, I like to paint images of my own body, despite the fact that nudity and erotic art are banned in Iran, sometimes without clothes, sometimes with clothes. Well, it's only a body, and we all have it. Your body, my body, is just a simple language of communication. And this is Shiva. My father did not think much of studying art. In fact, he wanted me to do computing sciences. But I persevered. He's a tailor, so I've seen all sorts of needles throughout my childhood. For my installation, I constructed two parallel white walls, creating a very narrow path or passage. I pierced these walls with hundreds, I think 1,000, large quilting needles. But for a kind of symmetry, I placed a matching number of soft, fresh, new leaves at the end of the path, awaiting the feet, inviting the feet, just like life. I think I have found a voice through studying art. I make comments about life. You register your voice by making art, don't you? I won a prize for this installation, and do you know what? My father approves of art education now. Ladies and gentlemen, the young generation in Iran, as well as the old, are alive and kicking, and we want to keep them like that.
BASIC stands for the British American Security Information Council. That may sound to you like a CIA front. It doesn't really matter what you think. Just listen to what I've got to say. The British American Security Information Council is an arms control organisation. Now, you might think that most arms control organisations are interested in preventing proliferation and indeed are interested in presenting all sorts of solutions to try to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. And if you thought that, you would be right. The consequence of this is that most of our colleagues in the arms control community have until very recently been arguing for sanctions in the Iranian case because they believe that Iran is indeed acquiring a nuclear weapons capability, if not with a nuclear weapons program. We part company with them for several very important reasons, but I shall go into what I think are the strategies that are being used by the US-UK administrations to create political consent and legitimacy for the forthcoming attack on Iran. I think that they are basically using a strategy which they have been using in the war on terror more generally to create fear amongst the population. And there are four key fears that I would like to address today that I think we as a movement trying to oppose this forthcoming military action need to address head on in order to gain public consent opposing war. The first is the portrayal of the Iranian leadership as mad and as extreme, the mad mullah syndrome, if you like. The second is their support for terrorism. The third is their threat to the region and, by implication, to oil supplies. And the fourth, of course, the most important in terms of the public perception, is their development of nuclear weapons. And I'll deal with each in turn. mad mullahs. Well, of course, with every sort of perception like this, there is a hint of truth behind it, but it is blown up and distorted beyond all sense of recognition with the reality. And even that hint of truth, if we look behind the causes of it, which have already been hinted at, we see a reflection of our own actions in the region. In the 1950s, Iran was a democracy. We positively and went out of our way to destroy that democracy and impose a dictatorship on Iran. So when the West talks about democracy, most Iranians see that as a Trojan horse, a veil for Western interests. So we, the so-called mother of democracy, have gone out of our way to destroy the reputation of democracy in the region, making it much harder for people to actually stand up in that cause. But it's not just the 1950s. We look at the isolation which the West has put on Iran in the more recent years. Even after the Iraq War, when Iran approached the US and Europe with quite radical proposals for rapprochement between Iran and the West, they were totally debunked and pushed away. In 2005, there was a comprehensive offer from the Iranians to stop almost all of their nuclear fuel cycle activities, specifically those that were most dangerous, the reprocessing and the heavy water reactor that they have been building in Iraq, and that they were just pushed away at that point, which shows the lie, as far as I'm concerned, to Western claims that they are wanting to hold Iranian development back on nuclear weapons capabilities specifically. Iran is basically, the Iranian leadership are portraying themselves, quite rightly to some extent, as the vanguard against Western imperialism and a world order that is discriminatory. And there lies the rub and the solution to much of the problems that Iran is just a symptom of. And the solutions lie here, not in Iran. The solutions lie in a more just international order, which we in Britain play a very important role in bringing about. Going on to the support for terrorism. Now, when people refer to this, they actually are talking largely about Iran's support for Hamas and Hezbollah. I'm not going to go into a great deal of detail about this, because actually in the last few months, if you didn't know very much about it before, you do now. And you realise that actually it's a lot more complicated than simply a few terrorists attacking a democracy in Israel. The blame is much, much more complicated than that portrayal. And I think that is why we are hearing less of Iran's support for terrorism, because the people who are painting this picture recognize that the publicity that these causes have received in the last few months does not play well to their agenda. So you won't be hearing so much about that more recently. The threat to the region and to oil supplies. Well, if you have a situation of injustice where you have one nuclear weapon state, namely Israel, and another nuclear weapon state, a hyperpower, with forces around the region occupying 11 countries that are neighbouring Iran, with a threat to overthrow the regime in Iran, without any recompense to international law, a clear demonstration of a willingness to do so with two neighbouring states, Iraq and Afghanistan, then you see the causes and the seeds for a threat to the current stability in the region, i.e. the current power balance. Now, all the while we maintain that power imbalance, Iran will be a threat to that, because they are threatening the injustice of the situation. Again, the solution is in our hands. Not only that, but the solution is in our hands to reduce our dependency upon oil in the region. This is a fundamental point. We need to move away, and this is personal as well as global. We need to move away from our dependence upon oil, because not only is it creating conflict in the Middle East, but it is threatening to bring our whole planet down with climate change. Then we come to the nub, the nuclear weapons. Now, Iran possessing nuclear weapons is a key challenge. I do actually worry about that as a possibility. Not because I don't trust mad mullahs, but because actually it threatens the non-proliferation treaty and the non-proliferation regime and threatens to spread nuclear weapons throughout the Middle East. This is a concern that is shared by many within Iran, which is why I think we have seen Iran sign up to and by and large keep to its commitments under the non-proliferation treaty not to develop nuclear weapons. They recognise that if they were to develop nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia would be next, Kuwait probably, Jordan may follow, Syria, Egypt, and before long you get a region that is highly unstable and the very, very real possibility of nuclear war. We have a situation where, as I said, there is an imminent military threat on Iran. That is the prime driver for Iran to acquire nuclear weapons. So the solution must be to withdraw that challenge, that threat. We have Pakistan and Israel having nuclear weapons already in the region. So it wouldn't be Iran that's introducing them to the region anyway. We have the spectre of the United States supporting Indian nuclear development further. It's clearly pointed to by the Iranian regime as hypocrisy that it is. And we have an international system that is totally hypocritical when it comes to the discriminatory nature of the possession of nuclear weapons. So I've hinted at a number of solutions here, none of which are coming from the West at the moment. But that it is in the West that the solution to this crisis lies, not in demands upon Iran. Having said that, I think we basically have to see signs of hope as well as this inevitable slide into war. And I will finish with the hope, because although I am pessimistic about this, we need to pick signs of hope and magnify them and work with them.
Kamin Mohammadi, who's an Iranian writer and journalist. She's just returned from a research trip in Iran where she's been looking into the after, or should I say the ongoing after effects of the use of chemical weapons on the Iranian people by Saddam Hussein's Iraq, backed up by the USA. Thank you.
Thank you. Iran is a country still recovering from war. The Iran-Iraq War, which started in September 1980 and lasted for 8 years until the autumn of 1988, it still has a direct bearing on the lives of many Iranians and has helped shape Iranian society as it is now. And it has certainly, in my opinion, contributed to Iran's current feelings about the international community. 500,000 people were killed. That's a conservative estimate. It may have been many more. And at least 1.5 million people were displaced. They were made refugees in their own country. I want to talk to you tonight about an episode in the war that's hardly been reported in the West, or even for that matter in Iran. Chemical weapons. They were used for the first time on a mass scale since the First World War, in this war against Iran by Saddam Hussein's regime. In total, 360 chemical bombs were dropped on Iran against both military and civilian targets, resulting in 100,000 casualties. There are now still some 45 to 52,000 people in Iran suffering severely from these attacks, many of them civilians who were not involved in the war but were just trying to live their lives. What's important to say at this point is that Iran is the only country in recent history that has had weapons of mass destruction used against it, and that by Iraq, in full view of the international community, which did nothing to help. Saddam's chemical attacks against Iranian civilians, all Kurds living along the border in Iranian Kurdistan, started in the spring of 1987. When the villages in the Barneh region of Kurdistan were attacked with bombs containing mustard gas. Then on the 28th of June 1987, the mountain town of Sardasht, also near the border with Iraq, was attacked with four bombs containing 250 kilos of mustard gas. These bombs were dropped in the densely populated town center, in places calculated to do the most damage. Sardasht is the first town in the world to be chemically gassed. And out of a population of 20,000, 5,000 people are still suffering severe after effects from these attacks. That's a quarter of the total population. Iraq's chemical bombardment of Iranian civilians continued with repeated attacks around the town of Marivan in March of 1988, with many villages attacked time and time and time again in the space of that month. These attacks continued throughout the province until June of that year. In fact, Iraq had been using chemical weapons against the Iranian army since the early days of the war, and Iran made repeated complaints to the UN, as this was in direct contravention of the 1925 Geneva Protocol, which bans the use of such weapons. The UN sent inspectors to the country to examine the evidence and issued two resolutions that mentioned the bombs. These resolutions, one issued in 1987 and one in 88, around the time of the ceasefire, were so weakly worded, and they failed to actually mention that it was Iraq that was using these weapons. So you can see that the international community's failure to in any way put a stop to Iraq's breaking of international law has led to a deep suspicion in Iran. What's more, since it was the Western powers that were equipping Iraq with weaponry and in fact providing the chemical weapons technology that Iraq needed to construct these bombs, Iran's conclusion was, perhaps quite reasonably, that the world was not interested in upholding international law when it meant defending a country it didn't particularly like. As Rafsanjani, who was then Speaker of Parliament, said 2 months after the ceasefire, and I quote, "The war taught us that international laws are nothing but ink on paper." The international community's indifference at the time had other tragic consequences too. The devastating chemical attacks on the Kurds of Iraq, specifically at Halabja, which for 3 days in March 1988 was bombed with mustard gas and nerve agents, killing almost instantly 5,000 people and in total 12,000. However, while the Kurds of Iraq are now seeing some recognition of their suffering and bearing witness to this at Saddam's trial, the chemical victims of Iran have had no such recognition. Time and again, the victims that I met and spoke to complained to me that being ignored by the world, not having Saddam be prosecuted for what he did to them, has made bearing their fate that much harder. And unlike Halabja's anniversary events, the anniversary of Saradasht's chemical bombardment is not attended by the great and the good. Nearly 20 years after the bombs were dropped on Saradasht, the Kurds of Iran are still suffering in silence. I accompanied an Iranian NGO called the Society for Chemical Weapons Victims Support on a trip to Marivan this summer and the affected villages around it. And I continued for a few weeks in Kurdistan to visit Barneh and Saradasht and interview other victims there. The intense welcome that we received in these villages made it very clear how little notice anyone has taken of them. In Qalliji in particular, our experience was very intense. People crowding around us to show us their injuries, bearing bits of their bodies, showing puckered bits of burnt skin, burnt flesh, showing pictures of their injuries at the time, pressing into our hands letters testifying to their suffering. What they kept saying to me as they held my arms and refused to let me go was that they were not recognized as victims by the world. "Why does the world think that we are the aggressors," they said, "when in fact we have been the victims?" These chemicals were used for the first time ever in Iran, and there are some that have still not been identified. Mustard gas was used during the First World War, but the type of mustard gas that was used during this war by Iraq was much more complex, completely different form, much more deadly. So these civilian victims were like an experiment for these weapons. And since there's no precedent, it's very hard to predict how, over time, people will be affected. So this figure of 45 to 52,000 is inaccurate, since there's no way of telling how many more people over time will develop illnesses related to these chemical bombs. Iran spends currently an estimated $67 million a year treating its chemical victims, but there are many more indirect costs. including the psychosocial damage to the victims themselves and their offspring. Generations born since the war to these people are also suffering, some from severe deformities and disabilities. And though there are as yet no studies done on this, and the evidence is purely anecdotal, there is some research that seems to prove that mustard gas can actually alter the DNA chain. There have also been no studies done on the effect on the environment, but there is again plenty of anecdotal evidence to suggest that people living in the affected areas have greater occurrences of diseases such as cancer. So even those who receive help from the government have very hard lives. Mustard gas is unlikely to be immediately fatal, but within a couple of hours it burns the eyes, skin, lungs and the throat, induces severe vomiting, and it stays in the body and it circulates, so progressively disabling every organ in turn. So there's no recovery for these people. They are just dying very slow, painful deaths. People pleaded with me to write down their names, to bring their stories to the West, and let people here know of their suffering, to stop there being such suffering in the future. So let me conclude in the words of Parvina Vahedi. She was 19 years old at the time of the attacks on Sardasht. She, 85% of her body was burnt. She lost one lung. She has severe asthma. She can't sleep. She lives on a cocktail of drugs. She spends 2 months out of every three in hospital. Her two teenage sons, she says, are psychologically affected by her depression. And she lost 11 members, close members of her family. She said to me, go and tell everyone that you can about this, because it's too late for us. But let this not happen again, so that we don't have to watch these flowers, our children, die in front of our eyes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be on the platform this evening. It's an especial pleasure to be sharing it with Hans von Sponeck, because he has been a supporter and friend of the Stop the War Coalition since its very early days, both in its activities in this country and in the work that we've done in the Cairo conference. So it's a great pleasure to be here with him tonight. I just thought, actually, coming up here, it's been an interesting news day, because certainly when I came out this morning, the headline news was that there had been severe rioting in Hungary because the Prime Minister had been lying to the population. Now, I make nothing of this ahead of our national demonstration outside the Labour Party conference next Saturday, except to say that the news also tells us that the Hungarian Prime Minister, to give him his due, in the midst of all this, issued a statement today saying that he had thought for exactly 3 minutes about resigning as a result of this situation, which I have to say I think is probably 3 minutes longer than Tony Blair has given the same issue any amount of thought at all. Except that is until recently. And though not a defender of the Prime Minister, I have to say that I do think that he's been giving this issue some thought in recent weeks. And I'm glad to say that he's been doing that, because now everybody knows, everybody in this country knows, and millions of people internationally know, that the Prime Minister of Britain is being kicked out of office because of the war in Iraq. That is a simple statement of fact, and it is being reported in the news media, even in this country, and certainly internationally. Everybody knows that it is the disaster of the Iraq war and occupation, the disaster of the wider war on terror, which has meant that the most successful Prime Minister that the Labour Party has ever had cannot stand in the next general election, and is now despised, it seems, not only by his Chancellor, who, to be fair, has always despised him, but by the majority of his cabinet, his party and his country as well. And that is not simply a product of the fact that his government has done terrible and destructive things. Many governments do terrible and destructive things, many governments preside over foreign policy disasters. There are even governments who are responsible directly and indirectly for as many deaths as the Blair government has been. But they are not always broken by their misdeeds, because what is necessary for them to be broken by their misdeeds is that there are people who hold them to account. And this government has been held to account, not simply by one great demonstration in 2003, but by an anti-war movement that simply would not let the deaths or the lies go unremarked. It is the stamina of the anti-war movement, as well as its scale, which has put the end to this particular Prime Minister's time in office. And I stress this point now because I believe we are arriving at, well, I think we are living through a particular moment, a particular historical opportunity, and I don't know how long it will last. There is an opportunity here because whoever comes after Tony Blair, even if it is Gordon Brown, who I know many of you may find this difficult to imagine, is absolutely, absolutely as pro-American as Blair himself. Whoever comes after Tony Blair knows that whatever their personal predilections might be, they are living in a world after the disaster of Iraq. You know, the Prime Minister himself is slowly, even himself, beginning to realise this. You know, we know from the leaked Downing Street memo that he wanted to have a long swan song of a goodbye to the country, that he wanted to go on songs of praise, that he wanted to go on Blue Peter and say goodbye to the country. Well, you know, clearly that won't be happening. I'm personally sorry that he won't be going on Blue Peter. I was looking forward to the moment where he explained to us all how you make a weapon of mass destruction in just 45 minutes out of an old squeezy bottle and some sticky back plastic, but we'll have to live without that particular experience, I guess. But everybody knows, and Gordon Brown must know, and any successor of Tony Blair must know, that they will fail as a Prime Minister if they cannot bring the foreign policy of this country into alignment with the views of the majority of people in this country, and that means a break with the neoconservatives in George Bush's administration. That's not just my view, it's not just the majority of the people in this country who have that view. It is the overwhelming majority of people in this country. I saw a poll 2 weeks ago, a respectable opinion poll, which said that 99% of the population of this country think there should be a break with George Bush's foreign policy. Now, you don't get 99% in any opinion poll. If you have an opinion poll saying there should be good weather tomorrow, there are some miserable gardeners who will say, no, it should rain. You don't get 99%. I mean, those of you who are familiar with statistics will know that there's a 3% polling error in any poll. So it may well be that there's 100% of the population who think that there should be a break with the Bush. Indeed, it may be that the 1% are simply people who didn't understand the question. So we can conclusively arrive now at a summary of the mind of the British people, which says, if we were to have it on a placard next Saturday in Manchester, Gordon, don't even think of staying in Iraq and Afghanistan. Don't even think about attacking Iran. That is the sentiment, not just of the anti-war movement, but a majority of people in this country. And the change of regime in this country is a chance to enforce that view on whatever successor government comes next. And it's an opportunity that we must not miss. And it's an opportunity not just for domestic political reasons as well. Even more importantly, it is an opportunity, a window of opportunity that has opened in the international situation as well. And here I want to just speak a little bit about the attack on Iran. On the attack on Hezbollah in Lebanon and its relationship to a possible attack on Iran. You see, if you're to ask yourself, why did that attack take place? Why did the attack on Lebanon take place now and in the way that it did? And the answer simply is this. The catastrophe of the Iraq occupation led directly to the attack on Lebanon. Why and how? Like this. Whatever the Pentagon planners thought they were going to get out of an attack on Iraq, whatever it is that they wanted, they haven't got. What they wanted was a stable, pro-business, pro-American regime in Iraq. Now, whatever you think is going to happen in Iraq, that is not going to happen in Iraq. And this is now the view of the departing British ambassador from Baghdad, of a senior American soldier in Iraq. It is an established fact beyond the doubt, even of the most boneheaded neoconservative analyst, that this is not going to happen in Iraq. Not that there can't be a stable government in Iraq, even now, but it can't be a pro-American government in Iraq. And there can be, and indeed is, a pro-American government in Iraq, but it cannot be a stable government of Iraq, for the very simple reason that most Iraqis don't want a pro-business, pro-American government in their country, and it is as simple as that. But this fact has presented the White House with a huge problem, because unable to build such a regime in Iraq, it has left Iran as an emerging regional power. And we know, as Abbas has said, as with or without the relevant footnotes Seymour Hersh has shown, that this is what is in the minds of the Americans now to attack Iran. But they are bogged down in Iraq, so they couldn't do it immediately. So they licensed their protege in the Middle East to attack what they believe to be the Iranian protege in the Middle East, which is the root of the Israeli attack on Lebanon. And this is what the Axis of Evil speech is about. This is what Blair's speech delivered to the cheering cohorts of the Murdoch press, the Arc of Extremism speech is about. They've spelled it out for you. You don't need to be in any doubt. It's not a conspiracy. It's out there in public. The Arc of Extremism is Iran, the Shia population of Iraq, Hamas, Hezbollah, Syria. This is now the way they are talking, and therefore what they are talking about is digging themselves out of a mess in Iraq, Jimmy Cagney style. Come and get me, Cockburn, I'm coming out, and I'm going to create a Middle Eastern conflict of generalised proportions on my way out. That's the business they're involved in, but the defeat in Lebanon has held them up. If that had gone to plan, and we know that even down to the military tactics, down to the bombing of the bunkers, it was a dry run for an attack on Iran. If that had been successful, we would be much further down the road than we are today towards a bombing of Iran. But I end with this. They cannot let it stand. Neither the Israeli government nor the Bush administration can allow what has happened to them in the Lebanon or in Iraq to stand. And they will be back at this business. Because the alternative, which every rational person in the world would take if they could, would be to get out. But to get out is to create a Vietnam syndrome which will make the original pale into insignificance. It will be to announce to everybody from Southeast Asia to Latin America that the writ of American superpower imperialism does not run. And that will not happen yet.
Hans von Sponeck is the former UN humanitarian coordinator in Iraq. We are very pleased and honoured to have him here tonight. We are proud that he has chosen to come all the way over here to add his voice to the platform we have today, to the range of anti-war activists, to the Iranian voices here tonight.
First of all, Rudab Shafi, thank you very much for inviting me. I also want to say, If John Rees would run for office and I was British, I would vote for him. Well, I've been asked to comment on two issues. One is, what about the impact of humanitarian, of economic sanctions on Iran? My answer will be brief and maybe a surprise to you. I don't think that there will be comprehensive economic sanctions against Iran. The key players around the globe see no justification. If you read the documents, if you read the speeches, the message is clear. Those who advocate sanctions are increasingly a Lonely Hearts Club. The UK and the US governments, and not many more. The world is tired. The world outside of Europe is tired with a double standard that we see. Remember the debate in New York a year ago about the non-proliferation treaty and the comprehensive test ban treaty. What a classic example of a one-sided imbalanced debate, and this hasn't gone unnoticed. So I don't think, as an optimist, maybe a bit naive, but it's good to be naive during these days, because to be crude in American language, that means you can be bloody-minded. And I think we do need to be focused and bloody-minded these days. So a little bit of naiveness is no problem at all. And therefore, I say with some conviction, I do not believe there will be comprehensive economic sanctions against Iran, because there is such a focused situation today with a small group on this side and a much larger group on the other. I'll get into this a little bit more during the time I have. But for the sake of going through with this question, if it were to happen, I think it would be horrific based on what we have seen happen in Iraq. The Iranian socioeconomic indicators, if you look at the UN Human Development Report, are pretty impressive. These socioeconomic indicators, in the case of multilateral sanctions that will not happen, but if they were, would very quickly go down as dramatically as they did in the case of Iraq, that was classified by the World Bank as a country in transition in 1989, a year before economic sanctions. I have the indicators. I will not go into any of these, but I just think there will be no such approach. If there are sanctions, there will be Cuba-type sanctions possibly continuing, because the Americans already have, except for pistachio nuts and a few other goodies that come out of Iran. Iran is a sanctioned country as far as the U.S. is concerned. The Security Council will not pronounce on comprehensive economic sanctions against Iran. There's one thing that we should keep always in mind when we discuss sanctions, and that is something which is much too little understood in the public, and that is there is such a thing as an undue future burden impact. And that is, I'm glad there were several references by my colleagues here about the impact on youth. Well, the Iraqi youth will feel the impact of sanctions long after nobody talks about Iraq sanctions anymore. And in our language, we talk about this undue future burden impact. And I think that should be used very much as an argument. The second question is to put Iran into an international context, to reflect a little bit with you on the current debate. And there's much to say. I don't have so much time to go into details. But I want to say 2006, this year, has shown a world that is undergoing very fundamental changes, not just in the Middle East, but globally, with great relevance to the Iranian debate. The Iran debate is no longer a debate in isolation. That's very important. Iran is today a recognized part of this Middle Eastern puzzle, and the interrelationships, quite understandably, are, by as far as the American and British governments are concerned, are underplayed in the political debate. But there has to be, and there is increasing insistence in many quarters, including international civil society, that there has to be a strategy, what I would call the strategy of the whole, only such a strategy, when you have a holistic approach, will lead to that which deserves the name of a Middle East peace process. It was always to me difficult to understand why that term was used to describe only the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Events in one part of this Middle East have an impact on all the other parts today. They always did, but now it is increasingly recognized. What is happening in Sadr city near Baghdad and in Najaf has relevance to Hezbollah and to Tehran. And the Hezbollah, let's face it, is becoming more and more a symbol of resistance in the whole of the Middle East, not just as far as the Lebanon crisis is concerned. And the events that happen in Lebanon link the discussion into Palestine, into Syria, and vice versa. What's happening in Iraqi Kurdistan, as far as the two Kurdish groups, the KDP and PUK, are concerned, has something to do with the Turkish politics, with the revival of PKK resistance. It's all linked. Iran and Syria, you know this better than I do, is heavily involved as far as Lebanon and Palestine is concerned. The Iran involvement in Iraq is, much is written about this. I think the case is overstated, quite frankly. There is an Iranian involvement, but let's remember the Iran-Iraq war. The soldiers of Saddam Hussein that were Shia did not run to Iran. So there is a much deeper division than is acknowledged, particularly by the U.S., that wants to now shift the attention from themselves to Iran as the main reason for the chaos that was caused by an illegal invasion into Iraq. So the complexity of the Middle East situation is not sometimes accidentally, I think much more deliberately, not appreciated by the political figures in Europe, in the US, and in the United Nations. There is an inability, seemingly, to pursue an integrated approach as far as the Middle East debate is concerned. Maybe it has something to do with the mechanisms that are not there or the capacity. The fact is the political will is not there to look and tackle this problem as a whole. And it is very interesting that the media has been unable to come in, with very few exceptions. We know them. You have some wonderful, and you can be proud of that, reporters, intrusive journalists here in the UK, like Robert Fisk and John Pilger and others who do write, but they are marginalized because they are perceived as a danger. The fact is that the media is much more attempted to get into the sensational aspects of the Middle East the debate. They write extensively about the Katusha rockets out of Lebanon into Haifa, or the Israeli defense force killing of farmers on the Syrian border, or Nouri al-Maliki's visit to Tehran, or Condoleezza's rise, a silly statement about birth pains of the new Middle East. What is very clear is Britain, maybe more than others, but others also, could show evidence that they understand the psyche of the Middle East, the psyche of Iran, the psyche of Iraq, the psyche of Palestine, and that we do not see at all in what is happening in Whitehall and in the White House. And then there comes this problem with which I had to reckon and I had to suffer from for a long, long while, and that is the cautiousness of the multilateral machinery, the cautiousness of the UN system. It is going to be, I think, a burden on the shoulder of a man that you and I, we all respect to a large extent, Hans Blix. But Hans Blix was too cautious Hans Blix should have, on the 5th of February 2005, in the UN Security Council, together with Dr. El-Baradei and the Secretary General Kofi Annan, they should have gotten up and walked out when Colin Powell presented a slate of lies to... That didn't happen because we are always intimidated. Why? Because the multilateral structure depends on this miserable money that isn't worth talking about in a global context. We're talking about $1.8 billion from 192 member countries. That is nothing. It's peanuts. And yet it's dramatized all the time, and it has put a sense of fear about the future of individuals and groups and agencies that call themselves the UN system. So that is a problem. As far as Iran is concerned, Mr. Baradei could have also, much earlier, issued a simple clarification. What are Iran's rights to use nuclear energy for peaceful purposes? What convincing assurance does the international community need that these intentions are peaceful? That could have been done much earlier than we now see at long last. Well, it's very easy for me to make this demand. But, and here I want to quote Nancy Söderberg, a U.S. diplomat. I very rarely agree these days with American politicians and diplomats, but here I do agree when she said, there is a breakdown of trust, and that is the most significant threat we are facing. Yes, the trust is gone. Remember the misuse of the UN Special Commission and the International Atomic Energy Agency in the case of Iraq? I was in that building, and it was full of espionage from all sides. And Iraq, the US and the UK used the United Nations to prepare an attack for Iraq. So was Iraq wrong in them not cooperating? There was that lack of trust in the wider context that is absolutely not surprising, and it is very relevant in the current environment in which Iran is trying to make its case. It's also these decades of a Western one-way street. That cannot continue. If we think we have all the answers and we insist that others must accept them, there will be nothing but failures. The G8 that meets in glamorous environments and makes promises, right now, again, we are reminded that the GA has failed in meeting its promises. There is a frightening double standard, I already referred to it, and not just with regard to nuclear energy or nuclear arms. Also, look at what happened to the Doha trade round. So, from New York to Doha, there is a double standard. And then you may wonder why I say this, but I say it quite consciously. What I now say is not a mistake. U.S. weapons to Israel? Why can't there be Iranian weapons to Lebanon? And then behind all of that, if I were an Iraqi, or if I were an Iranian, and then I read the PNUC, the Project for the New American Century, or the U.S. 2002 U.S. security policy, I would trust nothing coming out of the U.S. because the intentions are clear. Domination will continue. And then we have all these leakages of covert illegal actions. You have read it, as I have. I don't have to go into details. But Claire Shaw talked about eavesdropping on the Secretary General's floor in New York. There were listening devices in our building. The rendition flights, the CIA jails, the fundamental violation of international law from Guantanamo Bay to Bagram to Camp Buka to Abu Ghraib, and also to the United States. Wherever you go, there is international law is trampled with feet. And good speeches are made right now, as of today, in the United Nations General Assembly yet again. So we have cluster bombs, we have bunker busters, we have DU, we have it all. We have torture. The torture convention is ridiculed. The landmine convention is not followed. The Hague and Geneva conventions are at bay. They are belittled and rejected. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty is a joke, or is becoming a very dangerous joke. And then, ladies and gentlemen, it seems the motto, the means justify the end, I absolutely is an accepted motto. I don't know whether you read this horrific statement 2 days ago from the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the U.S. Congress, Peter King, who said, honoring international law, of course, "And if we capture bin Laden tomorrow and have to hold his head under water to find out when the next attack is going to happen, we ought to be able to do it." Now, if that is the basis on which we have a partner on the other side of the Atlantic, I'm sorry, we must reject that partner. I have a little bit more, and then you throw me out, I know. He would say, don't talk about this institutionalized misinformation, just call it lies. And that's what it, of course, is. I have so much one could cite here. Condoleezza Rice came to my country not too long ago, and she said the U.S. is acting in accordance with international law. And she said that in connection with the illegal flights and the secret CIA jails. Our chancellor said, "Thank you very much, Mrs. Rice. We are reassured." And then President Bush, a few days ago, as you know, admitted that there were CIA jails, there were secret interrogations of unnotified, by the way, unnotified prisoners, of course. And then you have Mr. Blair's 45 minutes, you have Colin Powell's 5 February story, you have the 3-2-month nuclear capability, that was an argument for a while as far as Iran is concerned, and you have the most recent example of a misinformation and a linked media bias, and that is the discussion in the Select Committee on Intelligence, where Iran's nuclear activities are described, and there is alleged evidence that in April of this year, Iran had already reached the level of enrichment that would allow Iran to produce weapons of mass destruction and become a nuclear power.